Hello, everyone, and welcome to our weekly podcast brought to you by VG Oncology. This week, we're continuing our special series focusing on bladder cancer to commemorate Bladder Cancer Awareness Month in May. Today's special guest is a professor of clinical cancer research at the University of Glasgow and is the director of the Glasgow Oncology Clinical Trials Unit. I'd like to welcome Professor Robert Jones. Welcome to VG Oncology, Professor Jones.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for taking the time. So to start off with, why don't you introduce yourself a little and maybe go through your roles?
So I'm Rob Jones. I'm actually half of my time is essentially as a NHS consultant in medical oncology, treating bladder and prostate cancer. And the other half of my time is my academic commitment, which, as you say, includes I'm the director of a clinical trials unit, also the director of the clinical research facility here at the Beatson in Glasgow. And of course, I also take part in and run a portfolio of trials of my own in urothelial and prostate cancers.
Brilliant. So, you know, now as an oncologist based in the UK, I'd like to talk about your experiences treating bladder cancer in the UK. So maybe can you provide an overview of systemic treatment for urothelial carcinoma in the UK and what clinical trials have influenced the current standard of care, please?
So, of course, I actually work in Scotland. And healthcare is slightly different either side of the border, largely due to some relatively minor differences in the way we're organised, but also maybe in this context, there are some differences which are driven by the different ways in which drugs are accepted for use within the NHS, i.e. it's NICE in England and Wales, it's the Scottish Medicines Consortium in Scotland. But fundamentally, the broad principles apply. So we're talking primarily about advanced urothelial cancer. We'll maybe touch a bit on perioperative treatment as well. But in terms of advanced urothelial cancer, I think the current gold standard, if there is such a thing, in the UK is still combination platinum-based chemotherapy initially. So that's either cisplatinum gemcitabine for those who are suitable. For those who are unsuitable for cisplatinum, carboplatin gemcitabine. And then if the patient's still got clinical benefit at the end of 4 to 6 cycles of chemotherapy, we will then go on to maintenance immunotherapy with avelumab. Now, there are some subtleties around that. So there are some patients who are, arguably not fit for any chemotherapy. The so-called platinum unfit population. That population definitely exists. I reckon it's about a third of patients actually are not suitable for any form of chemotherapy. However, in my experience, most of those patients aren't actually fit for or do not wish any treatment at all. But of course, there is evidence that you could offer, particularly in the PD-L1 positive population, that immunotherapy with either atezolizumab or pembrolizumab may be effective. And in England, atezolizumab can be used in that context. We have no funding approval in Scotland for that. And of course, there are those patients who do not have clinical benefit, i.e. they progress through chemotherapy, and for those patients, second-line immunotherapy is available. It would be atezolizumab in south of the border. It would be pembrolizumab north of the border. But of course, the problem is once you've had platinum chemotherapy and then you've had immunotherapy, there's a paucity of other treatment options available. We know enfortumab vedotin has a marketing authorization in that context, but there's no reimbursed access to it in the UK at the moment. So that's a bit of a bone of contention. We have historically used taxanes in the UK, particularly we've used paclitaxel. That was in the era really before immunotherapy. We used that as a second line treatment, if you like, after platinum. But remember that the evidence there was really relatively weak, and it's not, well, reasonably good evidence that it's not very effective. And certainly, you know, all the trials like the EV301 trial, the enfortumab vedotin trial, etc., and the immunotherapy trials in the second line setting, they all compared, randomized against taxanes. So they're definitely superior treatments to taxanes. So whilst taxanes are out there and available, they're not licensed, And I think they're relatively little used. I occasionally will use a third line taxane, maybe in a patient who's got significant disease-related symptoms, where the aim of the treatment is to try and alleviate those symptoms, but it's quite unusual. And of course, you know, there are other developments coming along. We maybe talk about them shortly. If we talk about the perioperative management, this is patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer. Again, the standard of care there should be neoadjuvant chemotherapy with gemcitabine and cisplatinum. Of course, there is evidence that maybe we should be considering dose-dense MVAC in that population based on the VESPA trial. I'm not aware of anybody in the UK who's currently using dose-dense MVAC as a neoadjuvant regimen. So I think pretty much the standard in the UK is gemcitabine cisplatinum. And then once you've had your cystectomy in the case of bladder cancer, if you still have residual cancer in the cystectomy specimen, then you still have muscle invasive disease present in the bladder, then those patients should undergo PD-L1 testing, and if PD-L1 positive, are often now offered adjuvant nivolumab. There is a role for adjuvant nivolumab even in patients who've not had chemotherapy, but I think those indications are relatively few, because of course if you've not had neoadjuvant chemotherapy post-cystectomy, you should probably be getting adjuvant cisplatinum-based chemotherapy. But if you're not suitable for it or refuse it and you're PD-L1 positive, then you could consider adjuvant nivolumab. The upper tract patients, of course, upper tract urothelial cancer, although they were included in the CheckMate 274 trial for adjuvant nivolumab, the findings in that subgroup were really quite questionable. And of course, we've got quite good evidence that chemotherapy is effective even in the cisplatinum unsuitable patients. In other words, you've had a nephroureterectomy and you have muscle invasive disease, PT2 or above, those patients should probably nearly all be getting chemotherapy rather than immunotherapy.
Brilliant, thank you. And you know, on the topic of checkpoint inhibitors, so you know, I'd like to discuss the role of PD-L1 testing. So, you know, in your opinion, what value does PD-L1 testing have in urothelial carcinoma?
Well, I mean, we've seen an awful lot of data about this, and it's very confusing and actually often quite conflicting. I mean, I think the simple answer is that in practice, there are only two indications where you might want to get PD-L1 tests. And the first is in that group of patients who are fully unsuitable for any platinum-based chemotherapy, and you're considering giving them an immune checkpoint inhibitor. There, the evidence is that the benefits really only apply to patients who are PD-L1 positive. So if you want to give somebody first-line immunotherapy, such as atezolizumab, then I would only offer that to a patient who is PD-L1 positive. The other indication is the one I've just referred to, which was in the post-operative, post-cystectomy setting, in a patient who's already had neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Because again, the current state of access, at least, is that nivolumab should only be offered to patients who are PD-L1 positive. But as I say, the data are really conflicting and confusing. I'm not sure that even those two things are correct. It's just what we can do. And remember, not all PD-L1 tests are the same. The way they're interpreted is not the same from one setting to the other. So you've got to really know what test you're requesting. Your pathologist has got to really know what you intend to do with the test result in order to do the correct test for you.
Great. And, you know, in the UK, only 30% of patients with advanced urothelial carcinoma receive first-line treatment, compared to approximately 40% in patients worldwide in a real-world setting, which represents, you know, an unmet need in the UK. So what can we do to enhance outcomes in the first-line setting? And what other unanswered challenges are there in this space?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, you can only really understand these figures based on real-world data, and real-world data come with a lot of caveats. But it definitely seems to be the case that there are surprisingly fewer patients accessing first-line treatment for advanced disease than we would expect, and possibly fewer than we would then compare benchmark with other countries, as you say. And I guess if you look at access very broadly, then we look at all sort. What are the barriers to that access? Well, you know, the first is that the treatments may not be available. Well, that shouldn't be true anywhere in the UK. These, you know, platinum-based chemotherapy and indeed the immunotherapy, the immune checkpoint inhibitors, are, you know, they're reimbursed. They're not reimbursed in Scotland in the first line setting, but as I say, that's not the standard of care for most patients. So cost shouldn't be the barrier. I think activity is a barrier. That, by which I mean, actually, you know, none of these treatments are cures, and I think that, you know, the activity of platinum combination chemotherapy, it's like any cytotoxic, palliative cytotoxic regimen, it's fairly finely balanced between the benefits and the risks, and it may well be that patients are being offered but then rejecting chemotherapy with good cause. Okay, not quite sure why that would be different in the UK than everywhere else, but it's possible. And of course, it may be that there's negativity amongst clinicians. And I think certainly one of the observations we've made with bladder cancer practices in oncology in the UK is that they're often or nearly always mixed in with wider urological practices, so mainly prostate cancer. And so actually a lot of people with advanced bladder cancer are being treated by clinical teams who actually don't treat very much bladder cancer, and so may not have the experience and the confidence to choose and offer these treatments more widely. So that may be one of the barriers to access. What can we do to improve it? Well, I guess we need to, so the first is where there's an assumption here that it needs to be improved. I think that probably is correct. But actually saying no to chemotherapy is not always the wrong decision. So we mustn't assume that we need to increase the numbers of patients getting treatment, because it's not going to solve the actual unmet need for all of these patients. But clearly we need to make sure that patients are being given accurate and comprehensible information. So we need to make sure patients are being offered treatments. We need to make sure that patients are actually seeing oncologists. In other words, you know, a lot of patients, you know, it's possible that patients are not being referred on appropriately. I think that's relatively unlikely, but it's possible. And that the benefits and disadvantages of systemic therapies need to be clearly articulated and explained to enable patients to make the informed decision for them. I do wonder whether we need to try and drive specialization. Don't have any data to prove it in this context, but if you look at a lot of other contexts in medicine, the best outcomes are often associated with people who are where the clinical team, it's not just down to the consultant, the clinical team is doing that thing, treating that disease consistently at high volume all the time. So there's lots of data in surgical cases, for example, where centers or practices that are doing the operation many, many times a year have better outcomes than people who only do it sporadically. And I think it seems very plausible to me that the same would be true of palliative oncology interventions. Actually, maybe we do need to look at the way services are organized. Do we need to try and set up more centralized, bigger practices with a particular interest, whether there's a multidisciplinary team which is focusing purely on bladder cancers or urothelial cancers, rather than this mixing it in with prostate cancer, which of course is a very different disease.
Great. And, you know, moving on to diagnosis. So considering the invasive procedure of the current gold standard for diagnosing bladder cancer, do you think liquid biopsies will play a significant role in the future of bladder cancer diagnosis?
I don't imagine liquid biopsies going to ever be a mainstay of diagnosis, you know, actually telling who's got bladder cancer and who hasn't. Because the benefits of liquid biopsy is actually more about telling you, giving you more information. So it's about giving you specifically genomic information. So I don't think it's ever going to replace the need for biopsies or transurethral resection of the bladder tumor. Of course, transurethral for resection of the bladder tumor may also have some actual benefits to patients as well, because it can help in controlling local symptoms. So I doubt if it's ever going to replace that, but it may well have a role in giving us more information about a diagnosis. And of course, its other role is that it may enable us to understand the cancer at a subsequent time point. So in other words, a patient maybe has had TURBT, then undergone cystectomy, and then, you know, years later has recurred with metastatic disease. And it may be that at that point, the liquid biopsy circulating tumor DNA test, really we're talking about here, may substitute for a biopsy, but it certainly may supplement the information that we know.
You know, and of course, you know, if we're talking about ctDNA and liquid biopsies, you know, how well do you think it will do in terms of advancing precision medicine in bladder cancer?
So at the moment, we don't have any, I'm just cautioning here because this information may be out of date by the time this goes out, but at the moment, there are no interventions that are based on a precision medicine test, i.e. a genomic test. But of course, we're about to see erdafitinib come on the scene. I mean, it has been on the scene in trials and in some circumstances in compassionate use for a few years now, but we've got now phase 3 data that patients with advanced urothelial cancer who've already had chemotherapy and immunotherapy may benefit, that selected, molecularly selected patients may benefit from erdafitinib, which is an oral fibroblast growth factor receptor inhibitor. But it only appears to work in patients with genetic aberrations in the fibroblast growth factor receptor. And so you've got to do the test. And about 20% of patients will have an aberration in the fibroblast growth factor receptor. So you don't want to be giving this drug to everybody. You do need to do that genomic test to identify which patients to offer erdafitinib to. And so that's going to come on the scene very, very soon, we hope. We've got the phase 3 data just came through at the end of last year. You know, hopefully we'll be seeing marketing authorization and hopefully some access within the NHS for that drug. But beyond that, that's the only drug intervention that's based on a genomic test. And the gold standard there is still solid tissue genomics, so TURBT or biopsy, something in a paraffin block, rather than a liquid biopsy. I think it is very likely that circulating tumor DNA tests will also help identify those patients. But I think it's worth emphasizing still the gold standard is a solid tumor test. So you probably should only be relying on liquid DNA testing for a patient where, for whatever reason, you simply cannot get a solid tumor genomic result. The other emerging indication for circulating tumor DNA, which is slightly different, is, of course, is in selecting patients for adjuvant therapy after cystectomy. So if you remember, there have actually been 3 randomized phase 3 trials of adjuvant immunotherapy after cystectomy. The first one, which was called InVigor 10, was of atezolizumab, and that was a negative trial. However, if you looked at patients going into that trial who had positive circulating tumor DNA, i.e. post-cystectomy, but pre-treatment, pre-randomization, patients had a blood test. And if that showed that they had circulating tumor DNA, and any circulating tumor, it wasn't specific genes, circulating tumor DNA, that subgroup of patients, when were randomized, obviously within the trial, where the patients who got the immunotherapy seemed to have a significant benefit over observation. So It may, so the hypothesis being that only patients with circulating tumor DNA post-cystectomy benefit from adjuvant immunotherapy. And there's an ongoing phase three trial called Invigor 11, which is specifically prospectively examining that group of patients, randomizing them for or against the atezolizumab. And it has to be said, the other two trials were positive. Of course, we've seen a third one relatively recently this year, the Ambassador trial of pembrolizumab, both showing disease-free survival benefit, but neither of those studies have shown an overall survival advantage yet. Whereas that subgroup of patients in Invigor 10, an unplanned retrospective analysis did suggest that there might be an overall survival benefit in that group of patients. So it may yet help us select patients for or against adjuvant immunotherapy post-cystectomy.
Great. And, next month, May, will be Bladder Cancer Awareness Month. I think an important aspect to talk about is, the patients themselves. So can you maybe go through, what specific survivorship needs are there for patients with bladder cancer?
So, of course, I've been talking all about patients with muscle-invasive or metastatic cancer. That's the minority, the small, relatively small minority of patients with bladder cancer. There's a big majority of patients with non-muscle-invasive bladder cancer. And so they have the very specific needs there. Now, I'm not the expert on that because this isn't the group of patients that we see. But, of course, the main clinical issue with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer is the risk of recurrence and the need for relatively invasive monitoring for that. And I think that's quite a big issue amongst that group of patients is can we find an alternative to having to have regular cystoscopies? Because it's quite invasive and unpleasant for patients. That's my impression. I guess there's also then the group of patients who've had more major surgery, particularly cystectomy, because cystectomy is really quite a mutilating operation. And of course, it's usually, nearly always done with curative intent. And so actually there's a lot of patients who've been cured of either high-risk non-muscle invasive disease or muscle invasive cancer who've been cured with cystectomy and then live many years with the consequences. And I think, they have significant needs relating to that, relating to obviously urinary function, but we often forget about things like sexual function and the likes as well after cystectomy. And then of course with advanced disease, unfortunately for most patients, this is a survival defining diagnosis, and unfortunately still for many of them it's time is very short. I guess we might sort of speculate that one of the problems we might face in the future is that actually these patients with advanced disease are surviving longer. We'll be able to see that soon as the treatments have become more effective, and of course we've got new treatment just around the corner, particularly this combination of enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab, which may enable a lot more patients to live longer with metastatic disease. I think it's at the moment it's only speculation as to what their unmet needs might be, but certainly the challenge of long-term systemic therapies, a lot of these patients will be on treatment for years potentially, and we'll need to begin to address what their needs may be.
Now, finally, as we look towards the future, I know that, you mentioned some therapies such as EV that are going to make a huge splash up in this space. So, what other advances are you looking forward to in the future?
So, the current challenge is trying to get access to enfortumab vedotin, and it's this combination. So we've already talked about its sort of third line, its post-chemo, post-IO use, but where it's really making its impact is going to be in the first line treatment as an alternative to platinum-based chemotherapy in combination with pembrolizumab. And so we've seen the results of the EV-302 trial last year, and it's well, we've never seen anything like it before in urothelial cancer, and we've rarely seen anything like it in any other, you know, uncurable metastatic solid malignancy. And so we really owe it to our patients to try and get access to that combination as quickly as we can. And cost implications are going to be huge, but you know, it really is it should be a seismic shift for this group of patients. But you know, again, it doesn't work for everybody, and it doesn't seem that it works forever in anybody. And so we do need to find other treatments. I've mentioned erdafitinib coming through quite quickly, but that's only for a subgroup of patients. And so there are new things. The next thing on the horizon, I guess, is another antibody drug conjugate. So EV is an antibody drug conjugate, but there's another drug called sacituzumab govitecan, which is a TROP2 targeted antibody with an SN38 payload. So the same principle as EV, but different target, different cytotoxic. We're expecting the first phase 3 results for that drug in the not too distant, I don't know when, but hopefully this year or early next year. That will be in that post-chemo, post-immunotherapy population. We've already seen some data. So obviously the key question for the future will be, is does that drug work in patients who've already had enfortumab vedotin, on the speculation that EV will become the standard of care. What evidence we've seen so far is that there doesn't seem to be a lot of cross resistance between these two drugs. That is, that if one will, you know, if you failed one drug, you may still benefit from the other. And so SG may become a treatment option for patients who've either failed platinum immunotherapy or potentially patients who've also failed EV. So we wait those results with expectation, and of course the other sort of area where we want to now start to see more impact is of these newer drugs in the perioperative setting. We've seen a lot of phase 2 data of using immunotherapy as a neoadjuvant approach, but we haven't yet seen any phase 3 data. We've seen the post-operative phase 3 data, and that certainly shows activity. I think we debate whether it's enough, but we should be getting results of the chemoimmunotherapy neoadjuvant study. So there's a group of these studies coming through, and I'm told we're expecting results by the end of this year of the first of them. And so that's giving chemoimmunotherapy combination as neoadjuvant, and then usually with a period of adjuvant immunotherapy afterwards, compared with the standard of care, which of course at the time was chemotherapy alone. So those data, of course, are exciting, because the hope with perioperative treatment is that we can actually improve the number of patients who are cured with systemic therapies. And then, of course, the next step after that will be, can we use perioperative antibody drug conjugates, in particular this combination of enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab? And I understand that there are two randomized phase 3 trials, one in the cisplatinum eligible population, one of the cisplatinum ineligible population. I believe they completed accrual, using these as essentially as neoadjuvant followed by adjuvant, and if we see the results that we've seen in metastatic disease replicated there, then we could potentially be substantially improving the cure rates in muscle-invasive bladder cancer. Beyond that, there's quite a lot of interest. There's a lot, you know, a number of other drugs being developed in urothelial cancer cohorts. In particular, I guess next up is probably going to be in terms of totally new drugs. There's a new swathe of immune therapies, in particular things like TIGIT, and then there's the mRNA vaccines, so the bespoke vaccine studies where you basically sequence the patient's tumor and you manufacture a patient-specific RNA vaccine, and so again we're going to be seeing trials opening there in particularly the perioperative setting, looking at adding in bespoke mRNA vaccines to immunotherapy in the post-operative setting. I think that's still, you know, that's quite sort of science fictiony. I think that we're still to really prove that that approach is going to work. To be honest, in my view, in any cancer, we've seen some enticing data here, but remember, there's quite a long litany of negative vaccine studies in cancer in general, including bladder cancer. So, I don't think we should assume that those will come into practice, but I think it's a very exciting area of development.
Well, the future looks very bright from what you've just said. So thank you to our speaker, Professor Jones, and to you, our listeners, for listening to this podcast. So if you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe in your favorite podcast app, including Apple, Podbean, and Spotify, so we can continue to deliver our expert-led content directly to you. Follow us on Twitter at VJ Oncology to join in the conversation, and visit vjoncology.com for the latest updates in the field.